is Michael McCusker. And before I start the program, there's a little... For the next fresh air is Barry Lopez, whom maybe most of you know is from Oregon, and is best known for his writing about the natural world. But he goes deep into his own inner life in an essay about how he was abused by a pedophile over a period of 4 years and how that affected the course of his life. Terry Gross talks with Lopez about his essay on confronting the trauma of sexual abuse, appearing in the January edition of Harper's. And any of you who are familiar with Lopez's work, you know he's one of the most prolific and best writers I think the state of Oregon has turned out. Well, I'd like to read a couple of things that I more or less took off my sister's computer while I was visiting her. And these are articles mostly from the New York Times, because that's what I would first check into every morning. And the first one I'd like to read is called The Life of Pi and Other Infinities by Natalie Angier. And it was printed on December 31st, the last day of 2012. On this day that fetishes finitude, that reminds us how rapidly our own earthly timeshare is shrinking, allow me to offer the modest comfort of infinities. Yes, infinities, plural. The popular notion of infinity may be of a monolithic totality, the ultimate, unbounded big tent that goes on forever and subsumes everything in its path. Time, the cosmos, your complete collection of old playbills. Yet in the ever-evolving view of scientists, philosophers, and other scholars, there really is no single implacable entity called infinity. Instead, there are infinities, multiplicities of the limit-free that come in a vast variety of shapes, sizes, purposes, and charms. Some are tailored for mathematics, some for cosmology, others for theology. Some are of such recent vintage their fontanelles still feel soft. There are flat infinities, hunchback infinities, bubbling infinities, hyperboloid infinities. There are infinitely large sets of one kind of number, and even bigger, infinitely large sets of another kind of number. There are the infinities of the everyday, as exemplified by the figure of pi, with its endless post-decimal tail of non-repeating digits. And how about if we just round it off to 3.14159 and then serve pie on March 14th at 1:59 p.m.? Another stalwart of infinity shows up in the mathematics that gave us modernity, calculus. All the key concepts of calculus build on infinite processes of one form or another that take limits out to infinity, said Stephen Strogatz, author of the recent book, The Joy of X, A Guided Tour of Math from One to Infinity, and a professor of applied mathematics at Cornell. In calculus, he added, infinity is your friend. Yet worthy friends can come in prickly packages, and mathematicians have learned to handle infinity with care. Mathematicians find the concept of infinity so useful, but it can be quite subtle and quite dangerous, said Ian Stewart, a mathematics researcher at the University of Warwick in England and the author of Visions of Infinity, the latest of many books. If you treat infinity like a normal number, he says, you can come up with all sorts of nonsense, like saying infinity plus one is equal to infinity, and now we subtract infinity from each side, and suddenly not equal equals one. You cannot be freewheeling in your use of infinity. Then again, a very different sort of infinity may well be freewheeling you. Based on recent studies of the cosmic microwave afterglow of the Big Bang, with which our known universe began 13.7 billion years ago, many cosmologists now believe that this observable universe is just a tiny, if relentlessly expanding, patch of space-time embedded in a greater universal fabric that is, in a profound sense, infinite. It may be an infinitely large monoverse, or it may be an infinite bubble bath of infinitely budding and inflating multiverses, but infinite it is, and the implications of that infinity are appropriately huge. If you take a finite physical system and a finite set of states, and you have an infinite universe in which to sample them, to randomly explore all the possibilities, you will get duplicates, said Anthony Aguirre, an associate professor of physics who studies theoretical cosmology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Not just rough copies either. If the universe is big enough, you can go all the way, Dr. Aguirre said. And if I ask, will there be a planet like Earth with a person in Santa Cruz sitting at this colored desk with every atom, every wave function exactly the same, if the universe is infinite, the answer has to be yes. In short, your doppelgangers may be out there, and many variants too, some with much better hair, who can play Bach like Glenn Gould. A far less savory thought, there could be a configuration, Dr. Aguirre said, where the Nazis won the war. Given infinity's potential for troublemaking, it's small wonder the ancient Greeks abhorred the very notion of it. They viewed it with suspicion and hostility, said A.W. Moore, professor of philosophy at Oxford University and the author of The Infinite, which was published in 1990. The Greeks wildly favored tidy rational numbers that, by definition, can be defined as a ratio or fraction, the way 0.75 equals 3/4, and you're done with it, over patternless infinitums like the square root of 2. On Pythagoras's table of opposites, the finite, and that's in quotes, was listed along with masculinity and other good things in life, while, quote, the infinite, unquote, topped the column of bad traits like femininity. They saw it as a cosmic fight, Dr. Moore said, with the finite constantly having to subject the infinite. Aristotle helped put an end to the rampant infinophobia by drawing a distinction between what he called actual infinity, something that would exist all at once at a given moment, which he declared an impossibility, and potential infinity, which would unfold over time and which he deemed perfectly intelligible. As a result, Dr. Moore said, Aristotle believed in finite space and infinite time, and his ideas held sway for the next 2,000 years. Newton and Leibniz began monkeying with notions of infinity when they invented calculus, which solves tricky problems of planetary motions and accelerating bodies by essentially breaking down curved orbits and changing velocities into infinite series of tiny straight lines and tiny uniform motions. It turns out to be an incredibly powerful tool if you think of the world as being infinitely divisible, Dr. Strogatz said. In the late 19th century, the great German mathematician Georges Cantor took on infinity not as a means to an end, but as a subject worthy of rigorous study in itself. He demonstrated that there are many kinds of infinite sets, and some infinities are bigger than others. Hard as it may be to swallow, the set of all the possible decimal numbers between 1 and 2, being unlistable, turns out to be a bigger infinity than the set of all whole numbers from 1 to forever, which, in principle, can be listed. In fact, many of Cantor's contemporaries didn't swallow, dismissing him as a scientific charlatan, laughable and wrong. Cantor died depressed and impoverished, but today his set theory is a flourishing branch of mathematics relevant to the study of large, chaotic systems like the weather, the economy, and human stupidity. With his majestic theory of relativity, Einstein knitted together time and space, quashing old Aristotelian distinctions between actual and potential infinity and ushering in the contemporary era of infinity seeking. Another advance came in the 1980s when Alan Guth introduced the idea of cosmic inflation, a kind of vacuum energy that vastly expanded the size of the universe soon after its fiery birth. New theories suggest that such inflation may not have been a one-shot event, but rather part of a runaway process called eternal inflation, an infinite ballooning and bubbling outward of this and possibly other universes. Relativity and inflation theory, said Dr. Aguirre, allow us to conceptualize things that would have seemed impossible before. Time can be twisted, he said. So from one point of view, the universe is a finite thing that is growing into something infinite, if you wait forever. But from another point of view, it's always infinite. Or maybe the universe is like Georges Louis Borges's fastidiously imagined Library of Babel, composed of interminable numbers of hexagonal galleries with polished surfaces that feign and promise infinity. And that's a quote. Or like the multiverse as envisioned in Tibetan Buddhism, quote, a vast system of 1,059 universes that together are called a Buddha field, said Jonathan C. Gold, who studies Buddhist philosophy at Princeton. The finite is nested within the infinite, and somewhere across the glittering, howling universe sample space, a Buddha field, or Babel, your doppelganger is hard at the keyboard, playing a Bach toccata. And that was by Natalie Angier, The Life of Pi and Other Infinities. And it appeared in the New York Times on New Year's Eve, 2012. And now, from December 30th, 2012, the day before, also in the New York Times, that would have been Sunday, Let's Give Up on the Constitution, by Lewis Michael Seidman. As the nation teeters at the edge of fiscal chaos, observers are reaching the conclusion that the American system of government is broken. But almost no one blames the culprit, our insistence on obedience to the Constitution, with all its archaic, idiosyncratic, and downright evil provisions. Consider, for example, the assertion by the Senate Minority Leader that the House could not take up a plan by Senate Democrats to extend tax cuts on households making $250,000 or less because the Constitution requires that revenue measures originate in the lower chamber. Why should anyone care? Why should a lame duck House, 27 members of which were defeated for re-election, have a stranglehold on our economy? Why does a grotesquely malapportioned Senate get to decide the nation's fate? Our obsession with the Constitution has saddled us with a dysfunctional political system, kept us from debating the merits of divisive issues, and inflamed our public discourse. Instead of arguing about what is to be done, we argue about what James Madison might have wanted done 225 years ago. As someone who has taught constitutional law for almost 40 years, I am ashamed it took me so long to see how bizarre all this is. Imagine that after careful study, a government official, say the president or one of the party leaders in Congress, reaches a considered judgment that a particular course of action is best for the country. Suddenly, someone bursts into the room with new information. A group of white-propertied men, who have been dead for two centuries, knew nothing of our present situation, acted illegally under existing law, and thought it was fine to own slaves, might have disagreed with this course of action. Is it even remotely rational that the official should change his or her mind because of this divination? Constitutional disobedience may seem radical, but it is as old as the Republic. In fact, the Constitution itself was born of constitutional disobedience. When George Washington and the other framers went to Philadelphia in 1787, they were instructed to suggest amendments to the Articles of Confederation, which would have had to be ratified by the legislatures of all 13 states. Instead, in violation of their mandate, they abandoned the Articles, wrote a new Constitution, and provided that it would take effect after ratification by only 9 states and by conventions in those states rather than the state legislatures. No sooner was the Constitution in place than our leaders began ignoring it. John Adams supported the Alien and Sedition Acts, which violated the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech. Thomas Jefferson thought every Constitution should expire after a single generation. He believed the most consequential act of his presidency, the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, exceeded his constitutional powers. Before the Civil War, abolitionists like Wendell Phillips and William Lloyd Garrison conceded that the Constitution protected slavery, but denounced it as a pact with the devil that should be ignored. When Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation 150 years ago, New Year's Day, this year, he justified it as a military necessity under his power as Commander-in-Chief. Eventually, though, he embraced the freeing of slaves as a central war aim, though nearly everyone conceded that the federal government lacked the constitutional power to disrupt slavery where it already existed. Moreover, when the law finally caught up with the facts on the ground through passage of the 13th Amendment, ratification was achieved in a manner at odds with constitutional requirements. The southern states were denied representation in Congress on the theory that they had left the Union, yet their reconstructed legislatures later provided the crucial votes to ratify the amendment. In his Constitution Day speech in 1937, Franklin Delano Roosevelt professed devotion to the document, but as a statement of aspirations rather than obligations. This reading no doubt contributed to his willingness to extend federal power beyond anything the framers imagined and to threaten the Supreme Court when it stood in the way of his New Deal legislation. In 1954, when the court decided Brown versus Board of Education, Justice Robert H. Jackson said he was voting for it as a moral and political necessity, although he thought it had no basis in the Constitution. The list goes on and on. The fact that dissenting justices regularly, publicly, and vociferously assert that their colleagues have ignored the Constitution, in landmark cases from Miranda v. Arizona, to Roe v. Wade, to Romer v. Evans, to Bush v. Gore, should give us pause. The two main rival interpretive methods, originalism, divining the framers' intent, and living constitutionalism, reinterpreting the text in light of modern demands, cannot be reconciled. Some decisions have been grounded in one school of thought and some in the other. Whichever your philosophy, many of the results, by definition, must be wrong. In the face of this long history of disobedience, it is hard to take seriously the claim by the Constitution's defenders that we would be reduced to an Hobbesian state of nature if we asserted our freedom from this ancient text. Our sometimes flagrant disregard of the Constitution has not produced chaos or totalitarianism. On the contrary, it has helped us grow and prosper. This is not to say that we should disobey all constitutional commands. Freedom of speech and religion, equal protection of the laws and protections against government, deprivation of life, liberty, or property are important, whether or not they are in the Constitution. We should continue to follow those requirements out of respect, not obligation. Nor should we have a debate about, for instance, how long the president's term should last, or whether Congress should consist of two houses. Some matters are better left settled, even if not exactly the way we favor. Nor, finally, should we have an all-powerful president free to do whatever he wants. Even without constitutional fealty, the president would still be checked by Congress and by the states. There is even something to be said for an elite body like the Supreme Court, with the power to impose its views of political morality on the country. What would change is not the existence of these institutions, but the basis on which they claim legitimacy. The president would have to justify military action against Iran solely on the merits, without shutting down the debate with a claim of unchallengeable constitutional power as commander-in-chief. Congress might well retain the power of the purse, but this power would have to be defended on contemporary policy grounds, not abstruse constitutional doctrine. The Supreme Court could stop pretending that its decisions protecting same-sex intimacy or limiting affirmative action were rooted in constitutional text. The deep-seated fear that such disobedience would unravel our social fabric is mere superstition. As we have seen, the country has successfully survived numerous examples of constitutional infidelity. And as we see now, the failure of the Congress and the White House to agree has already destabilized the country. Countries like Britain and New Zealand have systems of parliamentary supremacy and no written constitution, but are held together by long-standing traditions, accepted modes of procedure, and engaged citizens. We, too, could draw on these resources. What has preserved our political stability is not a poetic piece of parchment, but entrenched institutions and habits of thought, and most important, the sense that we are one nation and must work out our differences. No one can predict in detail what our system of government would look like if we freed ourselves from the shackles of constitutional obligation, and I harbor no illusions that any of this will happen soon. But even if we can't kick our constitutional law addiction, we can soften the habit. If we acknowledge what should be obvious, that much constitutional language is broad enough to encompass an almost infinitely wide range of positions, we might have a very different attitude about the obligation to obey. It would become apparent that people who disagree with us about the Constitution are not violating a sacred text or our core commitments. Instead, we are all invoking a common vocabulary to express aspirations that, at the broadest level, everyone can embrace. Of course, that does not mean that people agree at the ground level. If we are not to abandon constitutionalism entirely, then we might at least understand it as a place for discussion, a demand that we make good faith effort to understand the views of others, rather than as a tool to force others to give up their moral and political judgments. If even this change is impossible, perhaps the dream of a country ruled by we the people is impossibly utopian. If so, we have to give up on the claim that we are a self-governing people who can settle our disagreements through mature and tolerant debate. But before abandoning our heritage of self-government, we ought to try extricating ourselves from constitutional bondage so that we can give real freedom a chance. And that was Let's Give Up on the Constitution by Lewis Michael Seidman, who is a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University and the author of a forthcoming book on constitutional disobedience, and that's the title. And once more from the New York Times by Gretchen Morgenson, whom I read as often as I can, from December 22nd, we're moving back into the previous year, each article. A 2013 Guide to Better Behavior in Business by Gretchen Morgenson. As the new year draws near, I've been thinking about what might make it a happy one for investors, taxpayers, home buyers, and consumers. Herewith a short list, a short wish list. Make it sting. First, when regulators like the Securities and Exchange Commission settle with individuals after investigations, why not require those people to pay a sizable portion of the fines and penalties out of their own pockets? Only then will these deals deter bad behavior. Having these parties pay up would solve a big problem. They are typically covered by shareholders of the company in question or by that company's insurer. Making shareholders pay seems unfair, but that's the way it is now. There is a precedent for making individuals in such cases accept financial responsibility. The 2005 settlement in investor suit against WorldCom directors. Having presided over its huge accounting fraud and 2002 collapse, the company's directors were required to personally pay $18 million. Insurance covered the remaining $36 million. The amount that each director paid represented 20% of his or her net worth. Lawyers representing investors in that case made personal payments a requirement of the settlement. This should not be an anomaly. Wake up the regulators. And how about requiring some penalty for failure when regulators mess up on the job? We've all seen the disastrous results of financial regulators' failure to identify problems and nab scofflaws in the years leading up to the credit crises. And yet, none have been held accountable for these transgressions. Perhaps it is not surprising, given that almost no one in the private sector has been held responsible for misdeeds during the mania. But regulators should operate with a higher sense of duty to the taxpayers they serve. When they fail in that regard, there should be consequences. Solve the ratings mess. Why not ensure that investors get all the information they need to conduct extensive due diligence before agreeing to buy complex securities? This may be the only way to blunt the credit ratings agency's power or, better, make them disappear. 5 years after investors suffered billions of dollars in mortgage losses owing to the incompetence of Moody's and Standard & Poor's, it is beyond frustrating that these agencies still conduct their businesses as usual. And while the Dodd-Frank law was supposed to reduce the government's reliance on credit ratings, that goal has not been achieved. Reform of the industry seems to have stalled. The ratings agencies have also managed to continue hiding behind the defense that their ratings are opinions and subject to First Amendment protection from litigants. Being subject to lawsuits for their failures would surely encourage these companies to be more diligent. Maybe some of the ratings agency suits inching through the courts will get rid of this free speech fiction once and for all. Make leaders lead. Finally, wouldn't it be nice if executives acted like leaders and accepted responsibility for the actions of their companies and their employees? This dream came to mind while reading a deposition of Angelo R. Mozzillo, the founder of Countrywide Financial. His testimony took place in June 2011, but was filed 2 weeks ago with the New York State Court that is hearing a suit brought against Countrywide by MBIA, the mortgage insurer. Mr. Mozzillo is rarely heard from these days, so his views on the collapse of his company and industry are of interest. Early in the deposition, the lawyer for MBIA asked this of Mr. Mozzillo: after all the foreclosures and ruined lives and lawsuits, including the losses to MBIA, do you have any regrets about the way you ran Countrywide? An excellent question, given the carnage that Countrywide left behind. But not to Mr. Mozzillo, who answered with a version of history that is his alone. This is a matter of record, he said. The cause of the problems of foreclosures is not created by Countrywide nor MBIA. This is all about an unprecedented, cataclysmic situation, unprecedented in the history of this country. Values in this country dropped 50%. He continued by noting the financial misery at many banks, as well as at companies like AIG and institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This is not caused by any act of Countrywide or by any act of MBIA, he said. It was caused by an event that was unforeseen by anyone, because if anybody foresaw it, you would never have insured it. We would never have originated the loan, and it spread across the world. So that's the issue. All these lawsuits was created by nothing that anyone did, any one company did. Any judgment made on a foreclosure, on a loan being made, is because values deteriorated. And for the first time in the history of this country, people decided that they were going to leave their homes because the value of their home was below the mortgage amount, Mr. Mozzillo said. Never in the history of this country did that ever happen, and that could never have been assessed in the risk profile. These people didn't lose their jobs. They didn't lose their health. They didn't lose their marriage. Those are the three factors that cause foreclosure. They left their home because the values went below the mortgage. That's what caused the problem. So I have no regrets about how Countrywide was run. It was a world-class company, Mr. Mozzillo went on. So your tirade about foreclosures and lawsuits is nonsensical and insulting. Countrywide did not cause this problem. We made no loans in Greece. We made no loans in Ireland. We made no loans in Portugal. This is a worldwide financial crisis that was totally a shock to the system. Mr. Mozzillo's stated denial is pretty breathtaking. He did a fine job. That's his story, and he's sticking to it. Shareholders of Bank of America, who have shouldered billions of liabilities in its acquisition of Countrywide, might feel a bit differently. And that was Gretchen Morgenson, a 2013 guide to better behavior in business. And it was in the New York Times, December 22nd, 2012. And this has been Michael McCusker on KMUN and KTCB, Astoria and Killamuck, 91.9 FM and 89.5 FM. Perhaps I'll see you next Thursday on the radio. And if one of those drones doesn't incinerate me on the sidewalk, or the sky fall, or I slip into the river and find myself stroking out beyond the bar. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.